DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Daycock in Germany. This week on the show, Brandenburg elections, what the threat of an AfD win means for visible minorities.
And I opened the gate and helped my son to go out. And when I tried to close the door, and there was the guy, the same guy, standing there with a knife, then I immediately started running.
Workers and the far right, mind the perception gap, and Meloni versus Mussolini. No, not that Mussolini, this one.
The problem of minority, the problem of the people that have few rights. I think we have all have to deal with this kind of problems.
Thuringia and Saxony have voted. This week, it's the turn of Brandenburg. For the third time this month, voters are going to the polls in a regional election in an eastern German state with the far-right AfD party expected to come out top. We've spent a lot of time over the past few weeks dissecting what the rise of the AfD means for the German political landscape, and those editions of the programme are all still available on our podcast feed, including via the DW Podcasts channel on YouTube. This week, however, we wanted to focus on the voices of those who have most to fear from the AfD and the resentments it uses to mobilise its voter base. This report is from Ben Batke in Brandenburg.
Around 120 people have gathered at a central square in Neuruppin, a city of 30,000 northwest of Berlin in the state of Brandenburg. Signs read, "The government must go," and "Living in peace and friendship with Russia." People, tables, and a former fire truck are decked out in blue colors and posters. It's a pre-election party of the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD. In this Sunday's state election, the AfD and the ruling Social Democrats will go neck to neck. The AfD hopes to repeat its recent successes. In Thuringia, the AfD became the strongest political force, with 1 in 3 people voting for them. In Saxony, only the conservative CDU performed better. In both states, the Office for the Protection of the Constitution classifies the AfD as confirmed right-wing extremist. On the other side of the square, a slightly smaller group of people has congregated. Rainbow flags and anti-Nazi slogans are printed on t-shirts and decorate a car. Zaini Faisa, which isn't his real name, has come with his German wife and their 2 children. The teacher says the racism and xenophobia he faces in Neuruppin has been getting progressively worse since 2020.
Almost every single day nowadays, there are people driving by me and saying the N-word. Just between my school and the home, I feel sometimes insulted by 2-3 people. Do we have to run away? And we started saving about 7 years ago to buy a house. We got an offer about 3 weeks ago, but we couldn't decide. And we missed the chance, and it's really difficult for us, and we are really afraid.
Visible minorities' security concerns and fears for their future in Germany are far from irrational. On the contrary, a series of recent statistics, surveys, and studies show how a dramatic uptick in right-wing extremist violence puts people with a migration background at risk, particularly in East Germany. The Federal Criminal Police Office, for instance, registered 1 attempted homicide, 6 arsons, 2 explosives offenses, and well over 250 bodily injuries in the first 6 months of the year alone, and those are just the ones that get reported. The real figure is thought to be much higher. Faisa, who arrived in Neuruppin from Ethiopia almost 10 years ago, remembers a particularly menacing situation when he picked up his son from school around 4 years ago.
When I was crossing the road, but I saw someone who was smoking, someone who's really angry, and I opened the gate and helped my son to go out. And when I tried to close the door, there was the same guy standing there with a knife. Then I immediately started running. And he ran after me. There was a police and he was arrested. But after a while, I was called at the police station and they asked me if I drop the case.
Faisa says the experience shook him to the core. He now tries to avoid going outside without his wife, and they always accompany their sons wherever they go. According to recent surveys by polling institute Politics and Princeton University, A growing number of AfD sympathizers approve of violence against migrants and politicians of democratic parties as a means to influence political processes and drive away refugees. Back at the AfD event, the next speaker is Hannes Gnauk, member of the German parliament and leader of the AfD's youth organization, which Germany's Office for the Protection of the Constitution classified as right-wing extremist last year.
In my 10 years being active in this party, I have not met a single right-wing extremist. The government spends 50 billion euros per year on fighting illegal migration. It would be easy not to spend this 50 billion on any asylum seekers running around, but simply put it into our pensions. For us, the following applies in every policy area. Germany first. In a year's time, we'll chase the government out of their offices, and then we'll do politics for our own people again.
The AfD has been agitating against immigrants since its founding in 2013. Earlier this year, the revelation of their remigration plan, put forth by some AfD politicians, caused large-scale protests across the country. It would force millions of foreigners and even German citizens with a migration history to leave Germany. AfD politician Gnauk rejects the claim that AfD politicians' words and actions have contributed to the rise in both right-wing violence and the readiness among AfD supporters to use violence.
This has nothing to do with our electoral successes here in the East and at the federal level. After all, we are not militantly revolutionary at our demonstrations and summer parties. We are not inciting violence.
Joschka Fröschner from the association Opferperspektive, German for Victims Perspective, says that far-right hate crimes and violence have been rising again starting last year after the numbers decreased somewhat following a peak in 2015-16, when more than a million mostly Syrian migrants and refugees arrived in Germany. Fröschner believes that the everyday racism migrants in Germany face, people of color in particular, has a lot to do with the AfD's rhetoric.
If all the time you're painting migrants, refugees, and people of color as a danger, as criminals, as people only here to live on welfare, and who are stealing from the Germans, of course you're putting a target on their back. We witness attacks here in Brandenburg where the perpetrators say, "You see, the AfD will come for you." Even if the AfD denies sending that message, it's clearly taken up by people on the street.
According to Fröschner, victims of far-right and racist violence he and his colleagues support have reported numerous attacks with baseball bats, iron rods, knives, and arson attacks over the past few years. It is perhaps no surprise, then, that a recent survey by the German Center for Integration and Migration Research found that almost one in four people with a migration background considers leaving Germany in light of the AfD's rise. Close to one in ten have already made concrete plans, according to the survey. Moreover, more than one-third of respondents said they are toying with the idea of moving to a different state, in the event of the AfD participating in their state government. This Egyptian doctor, who has been living in Germany since 2017, is one of them.
We are thinking about moving away, especially my wife. She wears a headscarf and is afraid that she will experience even more discrimination. She has told me several times that we have to go to Frankfurt or somewhere else in West Germany, or just get out of Germany altogether. I don't understand how the economy is supposed to function without foreigners. In our hospital, at least 40% do not have a German passport.
Joschka Fröschner from the association Opferperspektive says his biggest concern in case the AfD will be in power is the pledged cut of state support for anyone who doesn't fit their racist worldview, as he puts it. In Thuringia, for instance, the AfD has publicly said it wants to get rid of civil society-driven pro-democracy projects, which received 6.1 million euros last year from the state budget. The Association of Counseling Centers for Victims of Right-Wing, Racist and Anti-Semitic Violence in Germany also warns of financial cuts to victim counseling centers in municipalities where the AfD has the majority or even statewide. In Thuringia and Saxony, exploratory talks between the strongest parties have not yet resulted in the forming of a government. All democratic parties have so far ruled out forming a coalition with the AfD. However, the ruling Christian Democrats, the winners of the state election in Saxony, are now reportedly in talks with the populist Bündnis Sahra Wagenknecht, BSW, despite initial resistance against cooperation. Fröschner warns that Germany's expanded border controls and other actions taken by the government coalition as a response to last month's deadly knife attack by a Syrian asylum seeker are playing into the hands of the AfD.
At the moment, it seems like the democratic parties are really playing the game of the AfD. by trying to adopt their policies to regain votes. And in a way, this is more dangerous than the AfD itself. Instead of supporting migrants and sending a clear signal that Germany is a country where people are welcome no matter their color of skin or their country of origin, parties are tightening asylum laws and are engaging in racist rhetoric.
In the end, this arguably reactionary course of action at the expense of migrants could backfire. Experts are warning that large-scale emigration would have disastrous consequences for Germany's economy, democracy and social cohesion. Ben Bartke in Neuruppin, Brandenburg, Germany.
Germany's AfD party is, of course, part of a Europe-wide phenomenon in which far-right populist parties are making gains at the expense of traditional ones. Such parties tend to present themselves as representing the interests of the white working class, as being pro-worker and ready to stand up for the so-called little man against the elites. But is that actually the reality? No, says a new report commissioned by the European Trade Union Institute, Mind the Perception Gap. I spoke to Gabriela Greilinger, doctoral student at the University of Georgia in the USA and co-author of the report.
So I think the main lesson, the main thing that we found is that the FARA does not vote in favor of workers' issues on the European level and that it does not behave like a defender of the working class on the European level. So while they might increasingly talk left-wing, they still mostly vote right-wing on the European level. I think what we also found is, what might be important to know, is that there is substantial heterogeneity in the voting patterns of the far-right, meaning that they do not have a clear voting pattern within their groups. So far-right parties tend to have strong voting discipline within their own national party, but not within their groups. So the ID group and far-right parties in the ECR group that we analyzed, they voted very differently.
That's really interesting. Can you give me an example, Gabriela, maybe of a vote, a key vote, where there were differences?
So I think one key vote that we could look at is, for example, the minimum level of taxation for multinational groups, so like corporate taxation. We see very different votes on this issue. So, for example, a few parties have rejected it, then a few parties have accepted it, and then we have some abstentions even. This is within ID. And then within ECR, we have the same pattern that a few parties have rejected it. The other half of the parties have abstained. And then there's one party that has accepted it, which is the Fratelli d'Italia, the Italian Brothers of Italy. I think another really important issue maybe to look at here is the minimum wage vote, which was largely rejected by ID. And then there is a very mixed voting pattern in ECR on this issue, where half of the parties have rejected it, the other half has abstained, and then two parties, again, the Italian party and the Greek solution, have accepted or have voted in favour, let's say.
So we've got differences between parties on specific issues, but generally the tendency is to vote pro-business, pro-capital, I suppose, and not in the interests of working people.
Yes, exactly. That is the main picture that remained after this analysis.
So why do you think it is then that the perception is so very different? Because, you know, whichever country you're in Europe at the moment, you will hear the refrain, you know, the elites are not listening to us, but at least whichever party it is has an ear for the small man, for the ordinary person. Where's this perception coming from?
I think it largely comes from people mostly looking at their discourse and not so much on their actual political behavior or the behavior in parliament and how they vote. Because, for example, if just giving one example, if you look at the Austrian far right, if you look at their voting in parliament, they largely also vote against workers' issues within the national parliament. They might talk very much pro-worker, but it always also has a very chauvinist touch. This is also what we see in the literature. So far-right parties are considered pro-worker and pro-welfare parties, but effectively, even if they are pro-welfare, it's mostly just the welfare for their own nation, so which we call welfare chauvinism.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Austria there, because I did actually want to ask you about Austria, because we are, of course, coming up to legislative elections on 29th of September. And so far, all the polling has suggested a very clear win for the right-wing populist FPÖ. But we've had a wild card thrown into the mix because of these extraordinary floods which have hit Austria along with other Central European countries this week. What are you observing at the moment, Gabriela?
Well, what we can see for now, all parties have technically agreed to stop their election campaign and just focus on providing help to the communities that were affected by these floods. But still, of course, we see that the election campaign has not actually stopped. This issue is already present in the public discourse. Personally, I do not think that this will in any sort of way really affect the election outcome. I think most parties have, well, most voters have already made up their mind on whom they're going to vote for. Some people have already voted. And so I don't really see how this is going to affect the success of one party over another. Also, because if we look at, for example, the far right, it has largely been already known what their stance is on environmental issues and on climate change. So I don't really see how their core voter base would change their mind now.
Finally, Gabriella, this report has been commissioned by the European Trade Union Institute. So it's something that they're obviously very concerned about, or at least wanting to understand better. What would you hope that their key takeaways would be from it?
The key thing that we want them to take away from this report is that far-right parties are not the defenders of the working class, and that also working class people or workers need to be made aware of the fact that these parties do not stand in for their interest at the European level. So that is something that they should disseminate.
Gabriella Greilinger is co-author of the report Talking Left, Voting Right, commissioned by the European Trade Union Institute. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Mussolini versus Meloni. It sounds far-fetched, but it's happened. No, I'm not talking about Italy's wartime dictator Benito Mussolini, but his granddaughter, Rachele Mussolini, a city councillor who won the most votes of any candidate in Rome's last council elections back in 2021. Last week, Mussolini left Giorgia Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia party for the more moderate Forza Italia. It's a move that is politically embarrassing, perhaps even damaging for the Prime Minister. From Rome, Megan Williams reports.
A major blow to Rachele Mussolini's loyalty to Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and her far-right Brothers of Italy party came this summer during the Paris Olympics.
He ran from Algeria.
Algerian boxer Imane Khelif defeated Italian Angela Carini, who withdrew from the match after a fierce blow to the head, falling to her knees in tears, saying it wasn't fair.
Caratteristiche genetiche maschili non debbano essere ammessi.
A controversy ensued, with some falsely claiming Khelif was a transgender woman. She's not. And Meloni weighed in, saying she opposed letting athletes with what she called genetically male characteristics compete against women. But Rachele Mussolini, a 50-year-old Rome city councillor who has long been part of Meloni's party, spoke out in support of Khelif, saying she was a woman suffering from a witch hunt. Since then, Mussolini has made clear her support of LGBTQ+ and citizen rights for children of immigrants, issues Meloni opposes, and issues that prompted Mussolini to say addio to Meloni's party, leaving Brothers of Italy for the center-right Forza Italia.
I thought that I could do something to change a bit the way of thinking of my original party. I tried. But there is no the time.
Says Mussolini of Brothers of Italy, a party, she says, that has not kept up with the times. She, on the other hand, says she has, crediting the education she received at home from her mother and her jazz musician father, Romano, the fourth child of Benito Mussolini.
My sensibility never changed because I grew up in a very open-minded family. My father was a famous jazz man, was an artist, a very open-minded person, and my mother was an actress.
That exposure to artists in her family, she's also related to legendary screen actor Sophia Loren, has led her to be more tuned in to people outside the mainstream, she says.
The problem of minority, the problem of the people that have few rights. I think we have all have to deal with this kind of problems, right and left, to find a solution.
But some Italians see Mussolini's leaving Brothers of Italy for the center-right mostly as a move away from a party starting to show signs of trouble.
She is clever. She probably decided now it is a good move to go into this center, because there is a lack of center in Italy. Everything is so polarized.
Says this Roman who works as a photographer.
I think Mussolini is leaving a sinking ship with Meloni's party.
Says this Rome teacher, referring to a recent scandal that has led to the resignation of Italy's cultural minister and close Meloni ally, who tried to hire his former lover as an aide, an abuse of public funds. Though Meloni is still the most popular party leader, support for her in polls since she was elected 2 years ago has slowly declined from 58% to 43%. And she's facing a major hurdle in 2025, her so-called the mother of all reforms, a constitutional reform to strengthen the role of the prime minister and weaken the role of the president. It needs to gain two-thirds support in parliament or win a referendum. Two former prime ministers, Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Renzi, failed in similar attempts.
So the fact that Mussolini decided to move to a more moderate party certainly is not good news.
Says Italian political expert Cecilia Emma Sottilotta. Sottilotta says that while Meloni has publicly distanced herself from her roots as a neo-fascist organizer, many party members still remain nostalgic for Italy's fascist past. That's a past which, of course, is inseparable from the name Mussolini. Benito Mussolini was the fascist dictator who ruled Italy from 1922 to 1943. He's still referred to with admiration by some as Il Duce, despite his jailing of opponents, persecution of Italy's Jewish population, and alliance with Hitler, the name Mussolini is still a vote-bringer. As Rome city councillor, Rachele Mussolini emerged as the most popular candidate during the last election here 3 years ago.
Italy hasn't quite dealt with its past as far as the fascist party is concerned. A big chunk of the population, even after World War II ended, remained somewhat in favor of fascism. There is also this sort of commonplace about Mussolini is that he also did good things.
That lingering nostalgia, Sottilotta says, is why
someone with a name, Mussolini, such a shocking name, can still be active in politics in the country.
Meloni has worked hard to prove wrong left-wing critics who accuse her of never having fully renounced fascism. The fascist flame, for example, is still a symbol of her party. But having a Mussolini family member leave her party, calling it too extreme, say observers, is a rebuke she can't ignore. Megan Williams, DW, Rome.
What's in a name? Quite a lot, it turns out. Time to say, I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany, here with a refreshingly youthful lineup of stories for you this half hour. We have the Finnish startup entrepreneur who created an app that's like Tinder for good deeds, 1,000 Turkish youth activists putting Erdogan under pressure, smartphones in school, to ban or not to ban, and not exactly young, but still youthful, the irrepressible Dolly Parton launches her own Prosecco label. But what do Italians make of it all?
I think that this product will be only for non-connoisseur, will be only for people that are interested in the song of this lady, and they cannot imagine that this lady has the knowledge, connaissance, capacity to select and to make a quality control for a good quality Prosecco. So she will make whatever.
Dolly, if you're listening, don't worry. You pop my cork every time.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
So, why the youth focus this week? Well, it's because over in Montreal, Canada, the One Young World Summit, which sets out to convene the brightest young leaders from over 190 countries and 250 organisations working to accelerate social impact, is underway. Over the next few weeks, we'll be introducing you to a selection of some of the European ambassadors to One Young World, and boy, are we all in for a treat. We're kicking off the series with Karolina Kauhanen, the co-founder, along with partners Sami and Ronnie, of Komu, an app which describes itself as Tinder for good deeds. In the space of just 2 years, Komu has grown to a community of over 70,000 users in Finland and abroad, won multiple awards, including Finland's Circular Economy and Digital Innovation Award and the UN Peace Award. Here's Karolina in her own words.
Hello, I'm Karolina Kauhanen. I'm from Finland and I'm one of the founders of Komu. So when I was growing up, I was very sick. So when I was 8, I was diagnosed with a very bad epilepsy. I got seizures. Worst times were every 15 minutes, also at night. Then at the age of 16, I lost the ability to walk for a while. I did recover from the injury. But during those times, and also during studies, when I was living in the capital region and abroad, I felt multiple times that I was the only one with these issues and struggles in the world, and I couldn't really find anyone to relate to. So that is one of the main reasons why I founded Komu, so that no one else would need to go through the similar experiences. Sami and Ronnie are longtime friends, high school friends. And Sami, he's a psychiatric nurse. He has worked on the mental health side his entire career. And Ronnie, he's a software engineer. So he has built different apps and softwares for large companies. And we met online by accident. And it's a funny story. The first time we met, I was actually on my honeymoon with my husband. And my husband was sleeping upstairs in the hotel room while I was talking business in the lobby with Sami and Ronnie. And that's when we decided that, all right, we're going to team up. We're going to build the first version of Komu, and we're going to see if anyone wants to use this. We hadn't built anything before. We haven't been entrepreneurs before. And we knew that, okay, it's going to be a lot of pressure and we need to, you know, work as a team through very intense things. So, you know, logically, we went to an escape room and it went so well that actually I'm one of the first investors in Komu. So after that escape room, when we were eating, I decided to invest. Today, Komu is reaching 100,000 users all over Finland, Norway and Germany. And we are looking to launch also in Sweden, Estonia and Latin Americas this year and next year. We have enabled more than 25,000 good deeds over the past 2 years, ranging from neighbors helping each other with groceries, walking the dog, to companies helping Ukrainian refugees. So Komu is actually available worldwide. We have multiple different language options. And you can be the first one in your own city. You download the app from App Store or Google Play. It's free to download and use. And you just post what you're looking for or what you can help with. And like Tinder, we match people who want to help with people who need help. So Komu in essence is like Tinder, but for doing good deeds. I speak to our users every day, and I have received a lot of help. Our users have distributed flyers in their neighborhoods. Just today, a nice chap from Forssa in Finland is giving an interview to the local newspaper and sharing his story of how he has helped. And I have also helped people. I have given out food, some miscellaneous stuff that was unnecessary for me. And I have also joined a couple of talkoot, which means these get-togethers where you do something good together. So I have helped, for example, an elderly man clean out his garage and chop some wood with a bunch of other Komu users. So when the war started, we received hundreds of messages within a day that Komu users want to help Ukrainian refugees when they are arriving to Finland. And a day after, we had the app in Ukrainian and we had all the necessary systems in place. And since then, we have enabled thousands of connections all around Finland and also in Norway for Ukrainian refugees coming to Finland. And one of my underlying thoughts there was that if I were to come to a strange country and I had to leave fast, I would like to find a friendly face. And also I would like to be that friendly face for someone.
Komu co-founder Karolina Kauhanen is the first of several One Young World ambassadors that we'll be profiling over the course of the next few weeks. The One Young World Summit runs until September 21st in Montreal, Canada. Apps can do it, as we've just heard, but arguably nothing brings disparate groups of people together like a common cause. It's a phenomenon that's happening in Turkey at the moment as young people from a wide range of different backgrounds and ideological persuasions mobilize around the issue of the ongoing killing of Palestinians in Gaza, where over 40,000 people have died with tens of thousands more suffering life-changing injuries. In particular focus, the perception of double standards on the part of the Turkish government, which is talking tough on the conflict whilst still allowing Israel to import weapons via one of its ports. From Istanbul, Dorian Jones reports on the movement calling itself A Thousand Youth for Palestine.
The latest protest by the group Thousand Youth for Palestine was over the killing by Israeli security forces of the Turkish-American activist Ayşe Nur Ezgi Ergi, who was protesting against illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. But along with condemning Israel for Ezgi Ergi's shooting, the demonstrators are also attacking Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for Turkey's ongoing trade with Israel. Gülsem, a university academic for Thousand Youth for Palestine, only wanted to be identified by her first name for security reasons.
I'm here to force Turkish government to stop oil trade with Israel, stop genocide. This is not just a public demand, it is also a legal obligation for Turkey to stop genocide.
In January, the International Court of Justice ordered provisional measures that required Israel to prevent genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, where over 40,000 people have been killed. Israel denies all allegations of genocide. Right from the start of Israel's most recent military campaign in Gaza, the student-based group targeted its activism against the ongoing use of a Turkish port for the export of Azerbaijani oil to Israel. Other targets included Turkish companies, many with close links to President Erdogan, who are using third parties to circumvent Ankara's embargo on Turkish-Israeli trade relations. The group uses social media to broadcast its message circumventing government-controlled media, a message that underlines its broad support that crosses Turkey's traditional religious secular divides. Gizim, a university student for Thousand Youth for Palestine, says that diversity is its strength.
When it comes to Palestine, it's a story that unites us all. So we are a group who can easily agree on what we can do for Palestine from here. Among us are those who define themselves as socialists and those who define themselves as Islamists. There are also apolitical youth who say, I don't like politics, but still join us.
Everyone needs to know.
All right.
Turkey is complicit.
Okay. Let's...
Police are cracking down on the protests. A state broadcaster panel discussion on Israel was disrupted by the group, resulting in a Palestinian member being arrested and now facing deportation. That has sparked more protests against Erdogan, who presents himself as a stalwart defender of the Palestinian cause. Also problematic for Erdogan, images of police arresting young women in religious headscarves. Sezen Öner is a commentator on Turkey's Politikyol news portal. She says the group's diversity poses Erdogan with a problem, given he has sought to exploit the deep divisions between the religious and secular.
It's actually portraying the current youth of Turkey, because you don't have a monolithic circus in the grassroots. You have a mixture, hybrid group of conservatives, conservative-looking but very progressive people. Such hybrid groups are coming together, united, because of a cause, but ideologically or background-wise or social class-wise, they may be very diverse. And that's something threatening for the government, because the government is embarking on divide and rule.
Erdogan lost heavily in recent local elections, a defeat widely blamed on a poor economy and anger over Turkey's ongoing Israeli trade. A success the Thousand Youth for Palestine says they will continue to build on. Murat, a university student for the Thousand Youth for Palestine, only wanted to be identified by his first name for security reasons.
The reason for our success is that we put our finger on the right spot. We expose the hypocrisy of both the capitalists, the corporations and the government.
The diversity of the Thousand Youth for Palestine is widely seen as its main strength and why it will likely continue to pose a political headache for Erdogan. But it may also offer hope that the deep divide of Turkish society can be bridged. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. You can, of course, also contact us via the comment function on whatever podcast platform it is the kids are using these days. And by kids, I actually do mean kids. So, smartphone use amongst under-15s is on the rise, and it's causing so much concern amongst parents and educators that various countries have begun experimenting with bans of one form or another. Most drastic of all have been Hungary, where a new decree requires schools to collect students' smartphones at the beginning of the day, and Sweden, yep, tech-savvy Sweden, which has gone down the route of a total ban and is also rolling back the use of other digital tech in the classroom. In the UK last week, a national academy chain became the first in England to go phone-free, a decision impacting some 35,000 pupils, with other education providers expected to follow suit. Dan Ashby is on the case.
Here's a question you might not want to answer.
What do you spend more time with, your family or your phone? It's no secret that smartphones rule the UK, but there's rising concern about what they're doing to our kids.
A lot of my fellow parents who had older kids just constantly had conflict with their kids about phones. I didn't speak to one parent who said, "I'm so glad I gave my child a phone." They all said, "I didn't want to, but I felt I had to."
The majority of British children own a smartphone by just age 9. But dad, Ben Lacey, has told his son he can't have one until his son turns 14.
You know, he'll cycle down to his mate's house and see if they're around and then go to the local park. So I think one thing is he's actually got more independence.
Ben is part of a campaign called Smartphone Free Childhood, and it's spread nationwide. The campaign cites worrying statistics, like how 12-year-olds spend on average nearly 30 hours a week on their phones. Meanwhile, contact time with their friends has plummeted.
Children end up, you know, literally walking around looking at their phones. And this isn't just some kind of, you know, weird Robocop 80s futuristic fantasy. This is observable now. So from a socializing perspective and from a pedagogical and learning perspective, phones are poison. Apart from that, I think they're great.
Tom Bennett is an educational expert who advises the government, and he says research shows smartphones lower grades and destroy focus.
So, I mean, there's games on your phones, there's amusing pictures, there's videos of cats falling off logs and stuff like that, you know, the important stuff. And compared to that, the idea of slogging through, you know, some kind of commentary on The Tempest, it's a hard comparison for kids to make.
The big worry, of course, is social media. Tech companies are accused of doing little to limit online abuse, bullying and sexting. Tom has visited 1,100 schools as an education expert, so I wanted to know, how much does all this go on? Using a smartphone to disrupt a class?
Incredibly common.
Okay, so what about kids using smartphones to share private information about their classmates?
Almost ubiquitous, incredibly common, on a minute-by-minute basis.
Okay, wow, kids using smartphones to demean their classmates?
Common.
Sexting, so sending sexual images?
Rare, but not rare enough.
Accessing pornography?
All the time, with gusto. You can't stop them.
Right, and the really scary one, having conversations with potentially dangerous people?
Uncommon, but many children experience it. And every child I know knows somebody who's had it.
It turned out to be quite hard to find anybody who would defend giving phones to kids. But likely you know phones' benefits anyway. They come with learning tools, creative apps and maps. Parents can stay in touch with kids and kids with the wider family. Cameras can be a vital tool for keeping documents, and the list goes on. And yet, one of the most common reasons for parents giving their kids smartphones is just so their kid isn't left out. Eleanor Farnsworth's son is the only child in his year not to have one. But she says it's gone down better than she expected.
Yeah, so my eldest is just gone into year 8, so he's 12. But obviously they all know he doesn't have one. And I checked with him again yesterday and he says nobody has made a mean comment about him not having one. So we've been really fortunate. Because everybody else is doing it, then the automatic reaction is, oh, well, we better do it too. Otherwise we'll look different and my child will look different. But I think the problem is that parents just haven't realised exactly what kids are accessing.
One 12-year-old who hasn't got a smartphone told us that life without it is actually quite nice.
People say, you know, you're going out without a smartphone. What if something goes wrong? Well, the thing is, you just need to know someone, like a parent or carer's number. And then you can just ask someone who seems nice to call this number if you're in trouble. And, you know, you can just talk to people. And I mean, that improves your people skills, social skills, and it can just be really good and, in fact, way better than just calling your mum whenever something goes wrong, you know?
Already, change is afoot. The British government has advised schools to ban smartphones and the UN wants the same globally. But this campaign wants to go further. No smartphones at all at home or at school until aged 14. No social media until aged 16. And so, they've written their message and hit send. And it's the smartphone on notification. Dan Ashby, DW in the UK.
Additional reporting in that feature was provided by Lucy Taylor, who, it is safe to assume, has Dan's number. If you're a child indignant about that report, you can email your complaints to insideeurope@dw.com. Parental feedback is also welcome, although, let's face it, you probably don't have time. Quick spot of audience research here. Which generation are you? Boomer, Gen X, Millennial, Gen Z, or simply category defying? Head over to this week's edition of the show on Spotify to let us know. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Sometimes you just have to end a programme with aromas of peach and apricot, a touch of sweetness, and a crisp finish. That's the marketing description of Dolly Prosecco, named after its enterprising owner, a certain Dolly Parton. Yep, the US country star known for such corking hits as Jolene, 9 to 5, and, like her new Prosecco label, her fine, persistent bubbles. But will all this be enough to convince Italians to give Dolly Prosecco a go? We tasked our bubbliest of correspondents, Danny Mitzman, with finding out.
Oh, Dolly, 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 40-odd years ago you were singing to us about working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. But now, at last, you're teaching us how to have fun.
Next time you're having a special occasion, make sure you try my Prosecco.
Yes, the bubbly queen of country has turned queen of the bubbly, launching her own brand with the British supermarket chain Asda. A DOC, meaning it's certified as produced in the Prosecco region, Dolly Prosecco apparently delights with aromas of peach and apricot, a touch of sweetness and a crisp finish. But what's an American singer-songwriter got to do with Italy's most popular sparkling wine, you may wonder? Apart from the fact that they're both extremely bubbly.
It makes me feel all fancy, and it tickled my nose. I guarantee you it'll tickle yours too.
The question really is, what is she trying to create? I don't see any value in it, bar her obviously making a lot of money, perhaps.
The oh-so-slightly sceptical voice of Martin Dibben, head of champagne for caterers Circe's London and former chairman of the Académie du Champagne. Martin is the UK sparkling wines expert, so much so he's known in the industry as Mr. Bubbles, so I was keen to get his opinion.
I mean, I think if I was a marketer, I would sort of say, oh, wow, this is an absolutely, you're just getting sort of an icon, you're putting it on something that is bubbly, you know, it'll sell like hotcakes, people will be able to identify with it, it's going to do really well. If you're someone that's from the region of Veneto and Prosecco, would you be so keen?
Not only does Martin think Prosecco is popular enough not to need celebrity promotion, he actually thinks it can be detrimental.
There are people working very hard in the Prosecco region to really establish its credibility due to the skill, you know, in the winemakers and on the quality of the grapes and the vineyards. So I think it's a shame for the region of Prosecco. It's just, again, keeping Prosecco in that position, marketing position, of it's just like easy drinking, bit of fun, and not really respecting, you know, those people that are working really hard in the region to create a beautiful drink.
Dolly Parton no doubt hopes her Prosecco will be as popular as Kylie's, whose bottles of rosé are ubiquitous in British supermarket fridges. But living in the homeland of Prosecco, I was curious to hear how Italians feel about non-Italian celebrities promoting, or nicking, their favourite fizz. Ironically, most Italians haven't even heard of Dolly Parton, and reactions at my local wine bars ranged from amused and indulgent to, frankly, vitriolic.
We Italians have a cult of good wine. For us, what's important is the name of our territories, so a famous person's name counts for nothing. But If she wants to try, that's up to her.
You have the Prosecco Rosé is good. If you have a good name, it's perfect combination. I think it's a good idea.
Siamo contrari.
We're against it. We're against them producing Prosecco.
Why?
Because it's typically Italian, so it's cultural appropriation.
So everybody agrees?
Yes. 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 Yes.
Would you drink branded Prosecco?
No, only for the brand, no. I have to know the origins, the quality of the wine, the quality of the ground, the climate in which it grows. Not for only the big name.
No, il punto non è tanto che non lo voglio provare.
The point is not that I don't want to try it because of the name of the singer. The fact is that they often put their names to a product without making sure of the quality. Famous people's names are more often than not associated with poor quality products, so I don't want to try it. I don't trust it.
We look for where it comes from, its geographical origin. And we read the label to see which winery it comes from, and we remember the ones we like. And it's not just because she's foreign. We wouldn't approve, even if it was an Italian celebrity.
Probabilmente non lo proveremmo.
Fantastico. Enjoy your Prosecco.
Grazie.
So, mixed reactions in Italy's wine bars. But of course, the most important opinions are those of the producers themselves. Getting hold of one was quite a challenge, as right now they're all in the throes of grape harvesting. Luckily, I managed a quick chat on Zoom with Sandro Bottega, whose family produce award-winning sustainable Prosecco.
I think that this product will be only for non-connoisseurs, will be only for people that are interested in the song of this lady, and they cannot imagine that this lady has the knowledge, connaissance, capacity to select and make a quality control for a good quality Prosecco. So she will make whatever. So it's a product for non-expert, for people, for consumers that want something which is maybe lifestyle. I don't argue, I don't think anything wrong, but of course it's not for connoisseurs.
If you're more interested in quality than celebrity, Bottega recommends looking for bottles with labels that say DOC Treviso or DOCG, indicating the specific geographical location of the vineyards. Or perhaps, like me, you might prefer Martin Dibben's priceless tip for selecting.
Have a fun time with it and just go to some of the good shops. Maybe buy their own brand, because very often you will get a very good quality Prosecco or wine from these own labels. You know, very often I think you get more value for money. Or just go out and see what's there. And then just buy a bottle of each. And then, you know, the best thing is to taste. And it sounds funny, because we're totally different. So we will like different things. So the best thing is to have a bloody good party and just make everyone taste it and see which one do you like and why do you like it. Once you've done that taste test, then you know what you like and what you're going to buy.
Saluti, Danny, and saluti, Dolly. Anything that brings more sparkle to the world is okay by me. And on that sunshine-inflected note, we reach the end of the show. This week's programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with more help than it is actually comfortable for me to acknowledge here from Nick Martin. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. We'll be back next week. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.